Answorth, Reel 11.
One of the men in my hut the night before, he'd been on a booze. We couldn't wake him in the morning. A chap called Cox. And eventually we sent for the medical chap and he came, took him away, and by 11 o'clock he was dead with yellow fever. So I suppose they thought, if we got yellow fever, we might as well go up the line and die down there. And so back we went up the line straight away. We went up to, first to Epey, E-P-E-H-Y. I went up there with two men to arrange for communications, you see. And I found a cellar, because it was in ruins, of course. I found a cellar which we could use. And then the ration wagon came up with stuff for us. And we passed a battery which was loading, fusing shells, a 6-inch battery. And there was a latrine there. And I thought, we'll just call in there for a minute, you see. We got to the top of the road, around the corner, there was a huge explosion. It blows off our feet. And what had happened, when Jerry had gone back earlier in the year, he'd left one of these delayed mines with the wire eaten through by acid, you see. And it'd gone up just then, right under this lot, under the latrine where we'd been. And this one of them, Steno, says, good job, you only wanted a piss, isn't it? If we'd stopped any longer, we should have gone up with it.
Can we concentrate now for a moment about the way in which artillery methods changed in the last 2 years of the war, the way they developed as compared with the earlier period in your experience? And start off by considering how your work against the movement of enemy supplies was affected by the introduction of harassing fire. Could you tell me what the technique of harassing fire was and why it was an improvement?
Well, as the term implies, the object is to put as much obstacle as possible in the way of the enemy getting supplies up. You want to deny him as many routes as possible. If you concentrate on the roads only, as we were doing at one time, road junctions were thought to be very important, you see, which they were, of course. Where the ground was hard, it could go across country with the wagons or horses, something like that, pack horses. So we started a different method of this harassing fire. The battery would take a section, an oblong as a rule, and the adjoining batteries in the brigade would take the adjoining sections, so that every part of the approach to the front line was covered. And each gun would have a lane in that oblong. And the guns would fire independently, say two rounds a minute, something like that, or maybe only one round a minute, just depending if there's much traffic moving. You would alter your range on your gun every time, so that in the area which you were covering, no one could say where the next shell would fall, so that they couldn't take a particular route and say, well, we're safe there. They weren't. They never knew where they were going to be hit. And one 60-pounder shell landing on open ground can do an awful lot of damage, especially with the later type fuses that were given, see? Mm. Because the earlier direct action fuse, the 44, had a fifth of a second delay, which meant that it went in the ground and dislodged several tons of earth without doing a fat lot of damage. But the later one had the 106 fuse, and that had a cap on the top of it, a safety cap, which had to be removed, a split pin withdrawn and the cap removed. That left a sort of a blunt-headed nail, cup-headed nail, with a bit of brass tape wound round it, and the tab end was left sticking out, and it was wound in the direction opposite to the rifling of the gun, so that when the shell left the gun, the air tore off that strip and left the nail loose. Well, the detonator inside was fulminate of mercury. When the shell landed, it acted so that the shell burst on the open without going in the ground, and the blast was directed practically horizontally over a fairly wide area.
I see. Now, another introduction in 1917, as far as your battery was concerned, was wireless for the first time. How were wirelesses used when they were introduced into your battery? For what purposes?
Receiving information from the planes.
yeah.
observation.
Did the introduction of wireless represent an improvement in any way?
Oh, yes.
What was the advantage?
Well, the plane could see, obviously, much further than you could from the ground. And particularly on road work, it was very good for detecting traffic in areas where we couldn't see because of probably folds in the ground or anything like that. And they could direct the fire onto that road. See, we had the maps. They didn't do anything about ranges. We did that ourselves off the maps, you see. But they could correct your range if you were not quite right until you could put paid to that road. The 106 fuse, which was used for shrapnel, that was an improvement on the old time and percussion fuse, which used to have to set it to so many seconds according to the time of flight. Well, that was supposed to burst in the air at the correct height above to spray bullets on the troops below.
Mm.
But usually they either burst too high or else they went into the ground, which did no damage whatever then.
Mm.
Well, this one, the fuse had a projecting ring on it. Very proud it was, and up to 9,000 yards, a 60-pounder lands on its shoulder, and that ring would contact the ground and detonate the fuse, and the fuse had a delay of a fifth of a second, which gave the time shell to bounce off the ground at just a nice height to spray the bullets forward as if they were from a shotgun. And against troops in the open, that was very, very effective indeed.
Mm. Now, in 1918, during the German spring offensives and during our own counter-offensive later on in the summer, the batteries would obviously be involved in a heck of a lot of movement. Could you tell me in a bit of detail what would be involved for the battery in actually getting underway and advancing or retreating as the case may be?
Well, all they do is bring up your horses from the wagon lines after dark and hook in and take them out. You'd bring up so many wagons to take the stores as well. You wouldn't have much ammunition to move because you'd fire most of that before you moved.
I see. And in advancing or retreating, were you forced to take any particular routes, say by virtue of having the horses to consider?
You had to keep within reach of plenty of water for the horses. So that usually meant on the Somme you were within reach of the River Somme or some of its tributaries, so as to get the necessary water. And that, of course, was a disadvantage in as much as the enemy knew that as well as you did, and he knew damn well that the riversides would be covered with wagon lines, not only artillery, but infantry and other people. They all had to have the horses near the water. And he could do a lot of damage like that, and did.
Mm. When did you start using gas shell, and how did that affect your work?
Oh, not until the latter stages of the advance. It wasn't until the... we were going to get the gas shell first, I think in the late summer of 1918. But we didn't use a lot of it.
Mm.
It was mostly the HE and the shrapnel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, after the Battle of Cambrai and the German counter-offensive there, your battery got stuck in no man's land. How did you get it out?
Well, with two guns in no man's land, the other four had been captured further forward. They'd moved them forward 2-3 days before, and they were captured in front of Villers Giesling. Well, the major determined to get these two out. So we spent the preceding day or two in preparing for it. The limbers were all, the wheels were bound round with the car tyres cut and round the wheel rim, you see, and then wired on. The drag washers, they put leather washers in place of them for the time being, you see. The horses' feet were all muffled in sandbags. Every link of the harness, all the adjusting links, they were all bound round with string. We pulled sandbags to pieces and bound it all like that. The driver's feet were in a sandbag so that his boots wouldn't rattle on the stirrups. And with preparations with the infantry, you see, there was some hastily dug trenches alongside Vorslet Farm, on the left of Vorslet Farm. It was only about 3 foot deep, I think. And a party of Lovett scouts were assigned to us Well, we got up there behind the Voslet farm in the dark, and then we moved forward over part of the trenches where they'd filled in for us, you see. And we got down into no man's land towards the guns, which are in the hollow at the bottom, and the Lovett Scout bloke came back and told us to stand fast. There was a Jerry patrol out. Well, we stood there for about 20 minutes, and believe it or not, blooming us sneezed or anything. They seemed to realise there was something wrong, and everybody stood dead quiet. And they came back and told us we could carry on. So we'd sent a party down first, before we moved the horses, to get all this gun stores loaded into the trail, which is a bit like a big hollow portion of the gun, fabricated from steel, you see, but it was hollow, and you carried your stores in there. Got everything ready, and the drag ropes hooked on, and the hand spikes into the gun sockets, ready for men to lift it, you see. Those sockets and these big long ash reinforced hand spikes, they call them. You socket them in the trail, and then four men lifted, you see, to hook it onto the limber. We got hooked in, and we started off cautiously up this this slope, you see.
Were you using all your horses?
With 16 horses to each gun. Normally there was eight. Well, on the limber, there's two outrigger swingle trees, you see, either side, which can put an extra row of horses. So your horses now were still four deep, but four abreast. Then we had a drag rope as well, with 30 men on either side. And so that was just to get the gun out the pitch, you see. And, we got so far, and then a gun... We hadn't time to silence them, of course. The gun clanked into a hole or something and made a big clatter. Well, of course, the next thing was Jerry started shooting, but he didn't seem to have any very lights or anything, fortunate for us. Well, at the moment they started, I mean, the major yelled out like to sort of let him go, and so with 32 horses onto the two guns, they soon was almost at a gallop up that slope. They didn't find the spot where it was filled in, but the horses jumped over the infantry, swearing like hell at us for crashing over them. And so we got up, the route we'd come. And when we got behind Vorslet Farm, the old man halted us. Oh, Christ, let's get out of this. But he knew what he was doing. A few minutes left, well, less than minutes later, the road from Vorslet Farm down to Hodicor was just one mass of shell bursts. And so he kept that up for about, I think, 10 or 15 minutes, and we stood there watching it all. Well, after he'd finished, we waited about another 10 or 15 minutes, and then Major just said to the Sergeant Major, "I think we may go home now, Sergeant Major." And so we moved off. We never had a casualty, and we got those two guns out like that.
Now, I know that the winter of 17 and 18 was a particularly cold one.
Yeah.
What are your memories of it, and are there any particular incidences which illustrate the... severity of it?
Yes, the gun recoil is controlled by the a spring and two recoil chambers. Two springs and one recoil chamber. And that recoil chamber is a long cylinder with a piston in it, which has a notch in the piston, and there's a rising ridge in the cylinder, so that as the piston rod, which is attached to the breech string, is drawn back, the aperture for the fluid gets less and less until it's virtually zero. In other words, the resistance is increasing. A 60-pounder normal recoil is 56 inches, maximum 60 inches. And that gun barrel weighs 4,200 weights, so you've got somewhat to move up and down. The oil in the gun virtually solidified, so that resulted, if they fired the gun, it either broke the rod or burst the end of the chamber out, you see. So they had to wait then until they got some glycerin, which of course didn't freeze, sent up. Next thing was, it snowed, and the frost was so intense that the snow didn't lay, it just lay like loose fine powder, almost like salt, on the surface. When you fired the gun, the blast from the 60-pounder, which is not like a howitzer directed upwards, it blew a huge pear-shaped patch of snow from in front of each gun, giving the position away to any enemy aircraft who were hastily skimming snow off the rest of the ground and scattering it over the part which had been obliterated, you see. We had to wait then until they got big white sheets which you could peg down on the ground in front of the guns, so that if it snowed, it didn't blow all the snow off, you see. That snow drifted up in the trenches, And yet it was bare on the top. The trenches had drifted full. We had to man a trench indoors up Chapel Hill there. It was in no man's land. And we used to have to crawl out there during the dark. And the infantry instruction was that if Jerry came over in the morning, anything like that, you see, we'd keep our heads down because they'd be sweeping the no man's land with the Vickers guns, you see. We didn't come over while we were there. But all we had to look through was a little slit. And one morning, this we'd had a new officer come to us, Mr. Jones. He'd come from the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, I think. But he'd only been a Buck Area man. And I had to take him up to the OP. The old man had a word with me before we set off, like, and sort of see he didn't get into any mischief, like. We got so far along, and he said we'd come the wrong way. So I said, do you know the way? He says, no. I said, well, how do you know if we're lost? Over, I stubbed my toe into the ground. He said, well, Stenhouse did, the man with me. Picked up the telephone line. I tapped in for him. I said, hey, I'll speak to the battery. And he said, hello, is that 144 heavy battery? And I kicked the telephone out of his hand. He promptly put me under arrest for assaulting an officer. So I said, well, you should have used the code name of the battery as a closer position. I didn't get reported over that. Mm. We got up to the support trenches, and then he said, he knew we were lost, he could hear somebody talking. He said, we're Germans. I said, it's the 21st Northumberland Fusiliers, are you? Geordies, and a Welshman couldn't understand a Geordie at all. We got up the front line, I thought, well, God help me, this fella's going to cause us some trouble. Jerry opens with his usual stand to, sometime later in the morning, the barrage on our lines. He comes bursting along, get me the adjutant, get me the adjutant. So I got him the adjutant at brigade headquarters through the OP exchange. Said the enemy was shelling our front line with 5.9s. So I said, not 5.9s, they're 77 millimetres.